Nemoto presents Addiction. Paychecks Not Punishments, The Shift That Saves Lives. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 23 minutes. Work sits at the center of stability for individuals and communities. Employment organizes time, supplies income, and provides affiliation. When addiction is treated as a human condition rather than as a property of a drug, the connection between labor, structure, and recovery becomes plain. People who are housed, who can meet basic expenses, and who have reasons to wake at the same hour each day are less vulnerable to cycles that revolve around substances. The reverse is also true. Unstable schedules, low wages, benefit cliffs, unsafe worksites, and punitive employer policies magnify risk and interrupt progress. Effective addiction systems therefore include a practical plan for employment and for the economic conditions that make work sustainable. Labor markets shape exposure to risk and access to recovery. In many regions, the growth of contingent labor and on-call scheduling has replaced predictable shifts. Income volatility drives stress, makes budgeting impossible, and undermines plans for treatment attendance, sleep, and meals. Night shifts and rotating schedules shorten sleep and increase reliance on substances to adjust state. Long commutes and unreliable transit multiply fatigue. Jobs without paid leave force impossible choices between a clinic appointment and a day's wages. Employers that terminate immediately after disclosure push problems underground until a crisis occurs at work. A system that intends to reduce addiction's harms must face these realities and design countermeasures that function in ordinary workplaces, not just in clinics. Employer policy is a direct lever. Written policies can state that substance use disorders are health conditions that warrant confidential disclosure and access to care, not automatic termination. Procedures can specify who receives disclosures, how privacy is protected, and how leave is arranged. Return to work plans can describe graduated schedules, temporary task modifications, and supervisor communication protocols that prevent rumor and humiliation. Policies can confirm that medications for opioid or alcohol use disorder are permitted when prescribed and that compliance will be verified through normal occupational health channels rather than through ad hoc judgment. Safety-sensitive roles require careful evaluation, but categorical bans are rarely necessary. Employers that operationalize these details retain trained staff and reduce turnover, recruitment costs, and accidents. Drug testing programs benefit from redesign. Blanket pre-employment testing for non-safety-sensitive roles screens out candidates without addressing impairment risk. Random testing policies that punish positive results without offering treatment pathways convert a medical condition into grounds for dismissal. A modern program defines safety-sensitive roles precisely, focuses on impairment at work rather than on remote use, provides confidential referral to care after any positive test, and allows return to work with documented stabilization and monitoring. The goal is safety with continuity, not spectacle with churn. Supported employment is the most reliable clinical approach for translating stabilization into wages. The core elements are simple and repeatable: rapid job search rather than prolonged pre-employment training, placements in regular competitive jobs rather than in long-term sheltered settings, coaching that follows the worker into the workplace, coordination between employment specialists and clinical teams, and respect for participant preferences about industry, hours, and disclosure. Employment specialists build relationships with local managers, learn what the job actually requires, and help solve problems that would otherwise trigger resignation or termination. Coaching includes attendance routines, transportation planning, communication with supervisors, and early warning systems for relapse risk. When supported employment is integrated with addiction treatment, retention rises and time unemployed declines. Apprenticeships turn recovery into skilled work. Programs that recruit from treatment centers and recovery housing can offer paid training with predictable schedules, mentorship, and a path to wage growth. Pre-apprenticeship courses prepare candidates for entry tests and provide basic certifications such as OSHA safety, first aid, and industry fundamentals. Sectors well suited to this approach include the building trades, logistics, healthcare support roles, clean energy installation, and advanced manufacturing. Success depends on coordination. Treatment schedules must align with class and shift times. Program staff must plan transportation and childcare, and employers must agree to structured leave policies that prevent abandonment when short crises occur. Unions and employer associations can support this design by writing accommodation language into agreements and by funding training slots earmarked for candidates in recovery. Benefit cliffs require explicit planning. As wages rise, eligibility for housing subsidies, food benefits, childcare assistance, and healthcare can drop abruptly, producing net income losses that discourage advancement. Case managers should use benefit calculators to plan transitions and should pair wage increases with temporary supplements or stipends when permitted. Local governments can smooth cliffs by phasing out benefits gradually and by offering earnings disregards during the first months of new employment. Without such measures, well-intentioned job placements collapse when families discover that a small raise has erased multiple forms of support and left the household worse off. Transportation and childcare decide whether a plan survives contact with reality. Predictable buses that run before dawn and after midnight, employer-funded transit passes, vanpool programs, and microtransit partnerships reduce lateness and absenteeism. On-site childcare stipends, and agreements with licensed providers aligned to shift work convert theoretical access to care into practical attendance. Schedules that acknowledge school hours and pediatric appointments reduce conflict. Telework opportunities where feasible expand options for those with mobility limitations or caregiving duties, provided that work quality and confidentiality can be maintained. Workplace design affects risk. Long shifts without rest breaks increase injuries and drive substance use to manage pain and fatigue. Environments without hydration, cooling, or protection from heat raise medical risk for individuals using stimulants. Repetitive tasks without variation increase boredom and rumination, both of which can trigger craving. Ergonomic adjustments, rotation of tasks, scheduled breaks, and attention to lighting and noise reduce strain. Supervisors trained to recognize early signs of withdrawal, sleep deprivation, or anxiety can respond with private referral rather than public accusation. Occupational health can integrate addiction care. On-site or affiliated clinics can offer confidential screening, brief interventions, and medication initiation with warm handoffs to community providers for ongoing management. Naloxone can be stocked in first aid kits and staff trained in recognition of respiratory depression and rescue breathing. Policies can specify that a medical emergency will be treated as an emergency, not as grounds for discipline. Supervisors can be trained to de-escalate, to call for medical help promptly, and to document events without stigmatizing language. After any event, return to work should be guided by clinicians who understand both the job demands and the treatment plan. Settlement funds from lawsuits tied to opioid distribution and marketing provide an opportunity to build the employment infrastructure that care requires. Investments can include job developer teams embedded in clinics, apprenticeship partnerships with guaranteed cohorts, childcare slot creation for families in treatment, employer training on fair chance policies, union-backed mentorship programs, and public dashboards that track employment outcomes. Funds can also support legal services that clear warrants, expunge records where permitted, and restore driver's licenses. The allocation logic is straightforward. Employment stabilizes households and reduces public costs across health, justice, and social services. Funding employment supports is therefore a prevention and recovery strategy, not an optional add-on. Legal and regulatory structures influence hiring. Criminal records, license restrictions, and employer liability fears create barriers disproportionate to risk. Jurisdictions can adopt ban-the-box policies that delay inquiry into criminal history until later in the hiring process, expand expungement eligibility for nonviolent offenses, reform occupational licensing rules that exclude applicants for old or irrelevant convictions, and clarify protections for employees using prescribed addiction medications. Courts can convert fines and fees to community service where appropriate and can consolidate debt to allow license reinstatement. Public defenders and legal clinics embedded in treatment programs can accelerate these processes so that job offers are not lost to paperwork delays. Fair chance hiring policies benefit both employers and communities. Employers can remove blanket exclusions, limit background checks to convictions relevant to job duties, and consider evidence of rehabilitation such as training completion, steady housing, and clinical engagement. Conditional offers followed by individualized assessments reduce bias. Probationary periods paired with coaching create real opportunities without ignoring risk. Employer associations can develop model policies and share outcome data to build confidence across sectors. Public procurement is a powerful lever. Government agencies can incorporate fair chance and recovery-friendly requirements into contracts for construction, maintenance, and services. Contractors can be asked to document policies on medications for opioid use disorder, return-to-work accommodations, supervisor training, and naloxone stocking. Contracts can include outcome reporting on retention, incident rates, and safety. Community benefit agreements attached to large projects can reserve apprenticeship slots for candidates referred by clinics and recovery organizations, with funding for transportation and gear. These levers translate policy statements into hiring pipelines that function month after month. Small and medium-sized businesses require tailored supports. Many lack human resources staff and worry about managing complex situations. Consortium models can pool services such as legal guidance, supervisor training, and access to occupational health. Chambers of commerce can host briefings on policy design, medication basics, and return-to-work plans. Local colleges and workforce boards can create rapid response teams that match candidates to openings, provide coaching for the first 90 days, and troubleshoot transportation and scheduling conflicts. Unions and worker organizations are key partners. Contract language can protect access to addiction medications, set clear procedures for disclosure and accommodation, and prohibit discipline for treatment participation. Joint labor management committees can oversee implementation, resolve disputes quickly, and adjust policies as data emerge. Training programs can prepare stewards to recognize health issues and to connect members to services. These steps align worker safety and employer needs, reducing conflict and improving outcomes. Rural and urban contexts require different logistics. Rural regions benefit from hub-and-spoke employment services connected to mobile clinics and telemedicine. Employers can coordinate with transit agencies to align routes with shift times. Local governments can offer housing stipends or conversions of unused buildings into recovery housing with on-site case management and Wi-Fi for telework. Urban regions can coordinate among hospitals, universities, business improvement districts, shelters, and workforce boards to concentrate services where foot traffic is high. In both settings, programs should track the basics. How many candidates were placed, how many remained at 30, 90, and 180 days, and what barriers caused separation. Measurement keeps rhetoric honest. Employment initiatives tied to addiction care should publish dashboards that report retention, hours worked, wages, promotions, benefit uptake, emergency department utilization, hospitalizations, arrests, housing stability, and family reunification. Data should be disaggregated by age, gender, race, language, and geography to reveal inequities. Risk adjustments should protect programs that accept higher acuity cases from being penalized for complexity. Where outcomes fall short, program leaders should adjust schedules, transportation supports, supervisor training, and clinical coordination rather than issuing slogans. Financing determines whether plans endure. Fee-for-service medical payment does not fund job development, coaching, transportation, or childcare. Blended models can combine health dollars with workforce funds, housing supports, and philanthropy. Value-based contracts can tie a portion of payment to employment retention and health outcomes, with safeguards against selective enrollment. Employers can claim tax credits for hiring workers with barriers to employment, and workforce boards can fund on-the-job training subsidies that offset initial productivity differences as staff learn roles. Technology can reduce friction when used with discipline. Scheduling apps can synchronize clinic appointments with shift rosters and public transit. Electronic records can generate confirmations that satisfy supervision officers without revealing clinical details. Secure messaging between employment specialists, clinicians, and participants can solve small problems before they grow. Privacy must be protected. Access should be consented and minimal. Data systems that become surveillance tools will drive disengagement. Systems that simplify logistics will increase stability. Housing and employment reinforce each other. Landlord engagement programs can educate property managers about fair chance housing, set up rapid response teams for noise or guest issues, and provide direct contacts for problem solving. Rent supports tied to employment milestones can stabilize the first months after hire. Lease preservation protocols can prevent eviction after a brief lapse by substituting additional supervision and support for removal. Without this integration, successful job placement is undermined by homelessness. With it, employment becomes the anchor for ordinary life. Workplace overdose response should be standardized. First aid plans should include naloxone, rescue breathing, and clear instructions for calling emergency services. Staff should be trained to recognize signs of opioid toxicity and non-opioid sedation, to position the person for airway protection, and to continue oxygen and ventilation until help arrives. Policy should state that an overdose is a medical event and that post-event evaluations will focus on safety and support. The presence of a response plan reduces death and signals that the employer regards addiction as a health issue. Sector-specific strategies make implementation concrete. Construction firms can integrate naloxone into site kits, schedule safety briefings that include medication basics, and coordinate with unions to protect treatment access. Healthcare systems can hire peer recovery specialists, align employee assistance programs with outpatient clinics, and include addiction training in supervisor curricula. Logistics companies can adjust route assignments to reduce sleep deprivation and can provide quiet rooms for rest between shifts. Hospitality employers can standardize break schedules and hydration to reduce stimulant overuse. Manufacturing plants can rotate tasks to reduce repetitive strain and can provide on-site physical therapy that reduces reliance on pain medication. Education and credentialing open doors that remain closed without proof of skills. Short-cycle programs, forklift operation, phlebotomy, sterile processing, basic coding, HVAC repair, solar installation, offer pathways to jobs with wage growth. Colleges can reserve seats for candidates referred by clinics, align class schedules with dosing windows, and provide tutoring and counseling on site. Completion rates increase when students have reliable housing, transportation, and childcare. Scholarships should include stipends for these basics rather than only for tuition. Return to work after a medical event requires structure. A plan should specify temporary duty modifications, check-in intervals, the clinical contact responsible for clearance questions, and a process for addressing rumors or stigma among coworkers. Supervisors should receive coaching on how to discuss performance without moral commentary. Human resources staff should document adjustments and timelines. The aim is measurable productivity and safety without humiliation. When these conditions are met, employees contribute steadily and colleagues learn that accommodation is an ordinary part of work life, not a special favor. Equity must be explicit. Women carry disproportionate caregiving responsibilities and face specific stigma. Schedules and childcare supports should reflect this reality. Older workers experience polypharmacy, chronic pain, and bereavement. Plans should include careful medication review and social reconnection. Immigrants face language barriers and documentation concerns. Programs should include language access and legal assistance. People with disabilities require accommodations that are often inexpensive but absent. Supervisors should be trained to offer them without delay. Equity reviews should be conducted at set intervals and should produce changes in location, hours, hiring, and supports where disparities are identified. Public communication should replace spectacle with service. Announcements can include addresses, hours, and eligibility for employment services tied to clinics, instructions for obtaining naloxone, and information about Fair Chance hiring policies. Media coverage should avoid images and terms that harden stigma and should report on measurable outcomes from employer partnerships and apprenticeship cohorts. Residents will support programs that show fewer funerals, more paychecks, and safer public spaces. They will resist programs that promise much and publish little. Operational reliability is the difference between policy and experience. Job developers must return calls. Vans must run on time. Clinics must have prescribers available when walk-in candidates arrive. Employers must receive responses the same day when problems arise during a shift. Hotlines must be staffed by people who know the local network and can connect callers immediately. Without these routines, plans stall and criticism grows. With them, trust builds and participation rises. A county or city can assemble this system in phases. A 90-day plan can designate a lead agency, map employers, unions, and training providers, Sign memoranda of understanding for same-day referral and return-to-work pathways, hire job developers and embed them in clinics, purchase transit passes for candidates, and publish a single referral number. A 6-month plan can launch apprenticeship cohorts in 2 sectors, open on-site childcare in 1 clinic, add evening hours at 2 more clinics, train supervisors from 10 employers, and publish a dashboard with retention and wage data. A 12-month plan can expand housing supports tied to employment milestones, add legal services for record clearance and license restoration, and renegotiate procurement contracts to include fair chance and recovery-friendly requirements. Program governance should be routine rather than heroic. An interagency board that includes health, housing, justice, education, labor, employers, unions, and community organizations can meet monthly, publish minutes, and review dashboard trends. When metrics worsen, retention falls, housing loss rises, overdose after hire increases, the board should assign a responsible party and a deadline for corrective action. Budgets should reflect outcomes. Programs that demonstrate improvement should gain capacity. Programs that do not should be revised or replaced. This approach aligns incentives with reality rather than with rhetoric. Economic analysis supports these investments. Retaining trained employees is less expensive than replacing them. Avoided hospitalizations and emergency visits reduce public spending. Stable households reduce foster care placements and justice involvement. Neighborhoods with fewer public overdoses attract customers and investment. These returns justify the inclusion of employment and housing supports within addiction budgets. It is not generosity, it is arithmetic inside a human framework. The overarching theme remains unchanged. Addiction is a human condition. Work supplies repetition, structure, affiliation, and income, the ingredients that make ordinary life possible. When systems make employment feasible, by protecting medications, smoothing benefit cliffs, providing transportation and childcare, aligning schedules, and training supervisors, the probability of sustained recovery rises. When systems ignore employment, plans unravel as soon as clinic hours end and bills arrive. Communities that design employment into addiction care see fewer deaths, steadier mornings, and neighborhoods that function. The methods are not dramatic. They are precise, repeatable, and suited to the seriousness of the subject.